The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You know, I think sometimes the media looks at a story like that Chick-fil-A story from last week, and they know that there's a religious angle there. They just don't know how to find it, or they misplace it. That explains a lot of the media coverage of that story. A misplaced religion angle, a misunderstood religion angle. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the Chick-fil-A flap, of the counter-protest that was planned but didn't really come off, and some other stories in religion news, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway. She's a reporter in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to GetReligion.org. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be here.
What is your, we're 1 week on the other side of this thing, what's your general take on the media coverage of the Chick-fil-A flap?
Well, of course, the whole flap started by the media basically inventing this story. They claimed that Dan Cathy was saying something particularly about same-sex marriage when he was actually made no direct comments about same-sex marriage, and was talking just about the biblical understanding of marriage, and was saying something, by the way, that is completely in line with stuff he's been saying for like years or decades. So they just completely invented this story and decided, like, oh, we're bored in the summer, we're gonna make a big deal out of this. And then when people sort of didn't like what happened with the story, they didn't really know what to do. So I think the media just, they're not very in tune with average Americans and how average Americans feel about, say, a mayor of a large town telling a businessman that because of something he said, he can't do business in his town or whatnot. I mean, they just are kind of out of touch with average Americans and what they think about government encroachment against free speech or religious expression. And they just didn't really know what to do with the story, I don't think.
Now, you also have written recently about, the best way to say it is the apparent inability or unwillingness of some reporters to remain objective of this, at least on social media. What did you find there?
Well, I don't actually know what happened in this particular story. There's a reporter down in at the News Press in Fort Myers, Florida, which is a Gannett newspaper, and he wrote on his Facebook page in the weeks leading up to the Chick-fil-A eat-in, or whatever you might call that protest that happened on Wednesday, August 1st. The Appreciation Day. He wrote all about his hatred for Chick-fil-A, and he's, you know, kind of a standard Romney-hating, Obama-loving reporter, nothing really new there. But then it turned out that he wasn't just someone who had really strong feelings against Chick-fil-A. He was actually supposed to cover the Customer Appreciation Day. And he said that he saw and heard things that were very different than things that were reported at other locations. He said that he couldn't get anybody's names, but he heard them saying really horrible stuff about immigrants, and, you know, they were racist and homophobic. And then he just, it kind of went downhill from there, and he was cussing at the people who had done it. People in his comment thread were encouraging violence against Chick-fil-A locations, and he was supportive of this. I mean, it just went completely out of hand. And of course, it was on his public Facebook page, so like 100 people shared it. And I was very curious what this would mean in terms of how he reported the story. Would he be able to separate his lack of objectivity on this particular issue and accurately tell what he saw? Would he have any evidence or substantiation for these kind of out there charges? And it turned out we don't know, because apparently his editor got wind of what he'd done and sent someone else down to write a story that matched very much with what you heard at other locations. Lots of families and people of all different kinds going down and supporting free speech or traditional values or whatever the reason was that they were there. So we got like a really good story from that newspaper that was very fair to all sides. So I don't actually know what happened with this guy. I mean, I know he's been disciplined, but I don't know what he would have written. We'll never know, I guess.
So, Molly, albeit this were things posted on his Facebook page, did he offer any kind of substantiation, anything he could directly quote? I know he said he didn't get names, but was there any kind of substantiation for the claims he first made there about
there
what he saw at Chick-fil-A?
Literally no substantiation. No substantiation at all. He said that, you know, he wished he had had evidence, but he didn't have any. And I mean, it's not like, maybe it did happen. I don't know. I wasn't there. It just was so outside what everybody else reported. And I myself was at a Chick-fil-A location in Virginia. And to say that that was very different than what I saw is an understatement. And every, you know, we're getting reports all around the country and nobody said that there was this like xenophobic, racist, homophobic, you know, spewing of hate at any location. You know, the only really hateful stuff we saw was actually from people who were opposed to Chick-fil-A on the other side in terms of vandalism of Chick-fil-A restaurants or harassing of employees or whatnot. So I'm not saying, I mean, maybe he just happened to be someone who hated Chick-fil-A who also happened to see some really horrible stuff, but that there was no substantiation for it makes me suspicious, I guess.
Now, this raises a question for me about kind of reporters, their objectivity on any story and general kind of requirement of objectivity and the social media. Where's the line there where a reporter can express opinions on his Facebook page, which everybody does from time to time, and doing his job?
I have absolutely no problem with people expressing their opinions, their personal opinions. Everybody has them, and there's nothing wrong with that. My own thinking on this, though, is that you should try, if you're a reporter and if you're covering, you know, your community, you should really try as hard as possible to have people in your circle, in your set of friends who have different perspectives than you do. It keeps you from demonizing the people that you happen to disagree with politically. Now, I have very strong views on all sorts of things, but I have friends who don't share those views, and it makes it so that I can't just, you know, spew hatred in their direction because I'm always thinking of these people that I like and I care about and who I've met and who I've heard explain to me their positions in very calm and rational ways. And even if I disagree, I know that I can't just demonize them in public media or social media, and I wouldn't want to because it's just not a good... Reporters should be open-minded to different perspectives, and they should also know that nobody really cares what a reporter thinks about a given topic. We care more about how reporters can tell us what other people think and how well they can accurately summarize other people's perspectives and news that is actually happening, not colored by your personal perspective.
How did the national class papers cover this, in particular the Los Angeles Times?
It was interesting. I actually thought the Los Angeles Times story was fine, although I remember it had kind of a silly headline and it seemed to take, you know, they put in little anecdotes that didn't seem to be that important, like a singular protester who was very offensive against Chick-fil-A or someone who showed up in a Superman costume. I don't think that really quite tells us much about what was going on. But actually, the Los Angeles Times gave it pretty significant coverage, whereas a lot of other papers, if they had anything at all, it was buried in the middle of the paper. And what was interesting is a lot of regional press understood that this was a big event. And I think to be fair, nobody knew how big it would be. I don't think anyone realized that this would be so many people, so many hours in line that people were willing to wait, stand up for free speech or for traditional values or to get waffle fries, whatever they were doing. I don't think that the media could have fairly predicted just how big of an event it was. But this did go on throughout the day. So once you realized, oh, wow, those lunch lines are going on for 3 hours, and, oh, it's 9 p.m. and the drive-through line is still crowded, you should be able to get a story in the next day's paper. And a lot of the big papers kind of ignored it. The Washington Post didn't have a story at all, and they ran a single photo in the middle of the paper, for instance. Just not really understanding your readership, I don't think.
How did the... At least it was described, it was sometimes reported, that there was going to be a counter protest, so to speak. How did that come off and how was it covered?
Yeah, and I've been trying to figure out which was planned first, the kiss-in or the eat-in, and I actually haven't figured that out yet. And I think that there was a lot of coverage or mentioning of the fact that there would be a kiss-in protest. And I think that's fair because it was supposed to be a big event. And I think that what happened is after after the eat-in happened, people maybe were less inclined to go do their protest that Friday because they kind of realized there was a little bit of a backlash forming. And so I think that what was envisioned as a really big protest ended up fizzling out, but you can't blame the media for giving it coverage on the way up to the kiss-in. And I think that actually, from what I saw, much of the kiss-in coverage was, as you would expect, very favorable or, not as hostile as you might see for people who have different perspectives. But I don't think it was particularly bad. I don't think it was too much coverage in the end, at the end of the day. And I think that the media realized that it wasn't as big of a story as they thought it was going to be, and so they recalculated appropriately.
I'm still trying to figure this out. Is the Chick-fil-A story from beginning to end, does it have a religious angle? And if so, how should it be treated by a responsible journalist?
Well, I think it most certainly does have a religion angle. I mean, this is a company that is closed on Sundays, which any reporter worth his or her salt should have known going into this, and maybe they wouldn't have made such a big production about comments that he made to the Baptist press. So obviously this whole story began with a discussion of biblical understanding of marriage and how the head of this company feels about that biblical understanding of marriage and what he does to support that biblical understanding of marriage. And so I think it's a completely legitimate religion angle. And it was his religious expression, which means that there are two First Amendment points here, you know, freedom of speech and also religious expression, that were attacked by these mayors in Boston and Chicago and the aldermen in Chicago. So that is also, you know, is it a free speech issue? Is it a religious expression issue? Is it both? That's also a very legitimate religion angle that should be covered. Now, when it gets down to people going and eating, you know, fried chicken sandwiches and waffle fries, I think that is less conclusive in terms of whether people were doing it because they don't like bullying by the media, whether they don't like bullying by mayors of big cities, or whether they are standing up also for the biblical definition of family, or what exactly. I think it's kind of a little bit more complicated mixture there. I mean, when I was covering it here in Virginia, there were gay people that were there to support Chick-fil-A who had no agreement with what Dan Cathy said about family. So it's a little bit more confusing in terms of what exactly was the story there in terms of that massive nationwide protest in defense of Chick-fil-A.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Molly about some other stories, religion stories, in the media on this Monday afternoon, August the 6th. Why did she want to write recently about CNN comments on Sunday's shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin? Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is our guest. She's a reporter in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to GetReligion.org. More with her right after this.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
By grace I'm saved.
Grace, God's favor because of what Christ has done for you. This is precisely the gift that you will receive at Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church in Strasburg, Illinois. God's grace delivered by the means appointed by our Lord Himself, His word proclaimed and His sacraments rightly administered. Come and receive. Grace, it's not just what we believe, it's who we are. Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church in Strasburg, Illinois.
We have a special premium for first-time donors to Issues Etc. It's the new Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio Mousepad. We'll send it to you for your first-time donation to Issues Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make your first-time gift by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, the 6th of August. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is our guest. We've got a few more minutes with her. Then Dr. Andrew Steinman joins us. The remainder of the program we'll spend, I think we're going to start doing it because there's so much more material that we need to get through. We'll probably have to extend it beyond the rest of today's program. A critique and a review of the Bible paraphrase, The Message, that was popularized largely by Rick Warren in his book, The Purpose-Driven Life. It was his primary go-to paraphrase for the points he wanted to make there. How does it stand up against a translation of the, is it a translation of the Bible? We'll answer those questions with Dr. Andrew Steinman on this Monday afternoon. Molly, why did you see fit to write about CNN comments on Sunday's shooting at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin? What did you find there?
Well, first of all, I mean, we, you know, at Get Religion, we frequently critique the how the media covers breaking news events like this. But I actually thought CNN did a great job yesterday. But at some point yesterday, someone puts on Twitter that, and I quote, actual CNN comments. And then he quotes that the comment was, Sikh people are not Muslim, but Hindu. They can be easily mistaken for Muslim or Taliban. Well, that was not something that was said by any journalist at CNN. Near as I can tell, it was made by a commenter online to a story they published. Which you can't hold CNN responsible for random internet trolls, or even if it's someone that they had interviewed who had said something like that, but I've found no evidence that those words were uttered on air. And so I think people sometimes just want to be outraged, and they want to show that they know more about this minority religious community than journalists do. And I just think it's a little bit unfair because CNN actually brought in religious experts. They were trying to clarify a lot of confusion people might have about the Sikh community, which is, you know, pretty small here in the United States. I think Pew Forum said that it's, you know, it's in the hundreds of thousands. It's not a large community. So there's not a lot of knowledge. There's a lot of confusion about it. And yes, CNN had some missteps, some word choices that could have been better, but I think that sometimes people just want to be outraged for the sake of being outraged, and it's in, by and large, I thought their coverage was actually pretty good.
Speaking of confusion, and on my part, pretty much stark ignorance, what was the confusion in the story from, it's datelined Turkey, and one of them appeared in a foreign press and the other in the New York Times, over various Islamic sects in Turkey and the Syrian revolution?
Yeah, so there's a group in Turkey that's a sect of Islam called the Alevis. Actually, I don't even know how to properly pronounce it, which is a shame, but Alevi, A-L-E-V-I. And there was a family that was persecuted in a village there. And it's a very tense situation because there have been previous problems in Turkey between the majority religious community and this community. And so the government officials there are kind of nervous that things could explode and whatnot. Anyway, when the New York Times wrote about it, they said that the group was Alawite. And what's interesting is it's kind of a similar word, and it's even, they're both from the same, these two sects are from a similar branch of Islam. They're actually not the same. And so Alawites would be in Syria, Alevis would be in Turkey, and they do have some distinctions. They're both considered heterodox Muslims, but depending on your perspective, one is more heterodox than the other. They have slightly different backgrounds and descents. One is an older group than another. And so it was just interesting that the New York Times got that kind of wrong.
Is it a realistic expectation when we're talking about, in this kind of case, microsects of Islam that no one, honestly knows about unless they Google it, for the religion reporting to get that one right?
I do think so, particularly because in the New York Times story, the whole point of it was that these people, who they called Alawites, were therefore kind of sympathetic to Assad and the ruling group in Syria, which is not you know, it was a confusion on what group they are, and they actually got that kind of wrong. They didn't have any strong evidence to support their claim that they were supportive of the Syrian regime, but they're actually, from what I've heard from people in Turkey and whatnot, that's actually not true, and that is not the basis of the conflict in Turkey, and it's not an issue that the Alevis really care about in Turkey anyway. And besides, they're just like completely different ethnic groups that were confused. So the whole point of the story in the New York Times was that they are Syrian sympathizers, and that's, from what I've heard, not accurate.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is a reporter in Washington, D.C. and a contributor to GetReligion.org. Molly, it's always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.